This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, we're going to check in with reporters from the Times of Northwest Indiana about the stories that they happen to cover on election night. In particular, we'll start out with the Times education reporter Carmen McCollum. She was keeping a close eye on two school districts here in Lake County that had referenda questions on the ballot and had a chance to talk with her on election night about the unofficial final figures.
The Crown Point Community School Corporation breezed through. They had over 70% of the vote where people voted in support of the referendum and continuing that that operating referendum that they initially got in 2011. Lake Central, the vote was a little bit closer, but the latest results show us that they have got that approved, that the voters did support that. It looks like they had, and I'm not sure, the numbers are not solid right now, but a little more than 53% in support of that referendum for Lake Central Schools Corporation.
That's good to hear. That's good to hear. From what you know, the assurance, I guess, the school officials in both Lake Central and the Crown Point school districts have had talking with the voters, I'm sure that it's been a longstanding campaign for both Superintendent Teresa Einman as well as for Superintendent Larry Verocco to make sure that the patrons in their school respective school districts know exactly where the money is supposed to go if they are allowed to have it.
Yes, I did a story on that, too, a couple of weeks ago, showing how they spent the money in the past. It was pretty detailed, and there's a lot of information in that story about, you know, what they did, how they paid teachers, how many teachers there were at each elementary school, the amount of money that the elementary school gotten, and that was for Crown Point. Of course, in Lake Central, their first referendum was a construction referendum, and they rebuilt much of the high school and built a new Proxman Elementary School. That's where that $160 million went. They're raising much less than that right now for an operating referendum, and it looks like they do have it.
From what you've done in talking with the superintendents and their staff who have been working up all the details of the financing that in turn goes down to just basically one brief question that shows up on the ballot today, are they ready to be able to take on the responsibilities of dealing with not only the handling the extra money that they're going to receive from their patrons, but also the responsibility of making sure that it's properly used?
I think that they are more than ready for that. Both school districts have shown that they are quite capable of handling that money, and there is transparency there. Anybody can ask for those records to see how they're spending that money and how it's going. And the Indiana State Board of Accounts also does an audit every other year, and they look specifically at referendum spending. It is a very specific category. It's not commingled with anything else. It is the separate referendum fund levy, and you can track everything that they do within that fund.
Do you think that that we talked here about these referenda vote, and I know since you cover the public education sector beyond these particular schools, we know that we had a chance to talk with State Representative Earl Harris during the last few minutes about the upcoming special session of the General Assembly next week, and we know that the school takeover bill that didn't make it through during the regular length session is coming back up again for review, and I understand too that it was the only measure of all of them that's coming up in the special session that actually took in some public comment. Did you have a chance to check on that?
I have not taken a look at that right just yet. I'll probably be looking at that as that special session gets started.
Mm-hmm. Carmen McCollum covers education issues for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Carmen, thank you very much for the update. We appreciate your work this evening and look forward to seeing what comes out in print as well as online here in the editions tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great night.
Thank you. conversation with Carmen McCullum we had here on election night. And we have turned out back with Dan Carton with the Times of Northwest Indiana. Before we look at the stories that you had in the paper, Dan, here on election night, on the races that you were keeping a close eye on, let's take a look first here about upcoming special session. We had kind of gotten into that conversation on election night with Carmen here, mainly about the big attraction, for at least for us here in Northwest Indiana, that's going to come up at the special session, the school takeover bill.
They actually took over the school district last year. This really, House Bill 1315, kind of cleans up that original measure to, in this case, as it pertains to Gary, further sideline the Gary school trustees. These are elected officials, but they don't really have anything to do because last year the state put an emergency manager in charge of the district after the trustees repeatedly failed to balance the district's budget and racked up more than $100 million in debt. So the trustees still exist. They still meet on a monthly basis, but there's really nothing for them to do. So this legislation would officially sort of undesignate them as the governing body of the school district, since the emergency manager is the person who's actually doing that under the supervision of the state's Distressed Unit Appeals Board, and would limit them to 4 public meetings a year because the Gary School Board has kind of a reputation for having many, many meetings that don't accomplish very much.
I know that you mentioned in your story, in particular here kind of ahead of the special session, that that Hoosiers will get a chance to actually have a chance to take a look at the material that is going to come up before the General Assembly special session on May 14th. Tell us where people can check out this information on the bills that are, along with House Bill 1315, the other measures that are going to be up for review.
Sure. Those are all posted on the General Assembly website at iga.in.gov. There's going to be 5 measures. 2 of them make some revisions to Indiana tax law to comply with the recently enacted federal changes. There's the House Bill 1315, the school, the Gary Muncy school legislation, and there's a measure to increase school safety funding. Indiana puts about $9 million a year into secured school safety grants. This year, the state got $12 million in requests, so this would throw some money at that to fulfill those requests. And then the 5th measure is what's called a technical corrections bill. These are done every session. It's just to find a few errors in the Indiana code and correct them. There were also some bills that passed in the regular session that had provisions that amended parts of the code and other provisions that deleted parts of the code. So this just sort of fixes all of those conflicts.
Now, we know that they do have a set time for this special session. Is it your opinion from watching these others happen at the State House, although not many, I guess, special sessions, they still have been out there. Are they liable to get everything done that they really need to get done in the time limit?
Yeah, well, there's not a limit. Special sessions theoretically can go forever. Mm-hmm. But the House and Senate leaders, who are both Republicans, have said that their goal is to get it done in one day. And on Monday, this past Monday, they came in and approved the rules that would allow them to get it done in one day. Under the Constitution, for example, legislation has to be read on 3 separate days. House and Senate rules also, you know, require committee meetings and other processes. What they've done is prepared a resolution that lawmakers will vote on at the start of the special session. Needs 2/3 of the members to pass, and Republicans have more than 2/3 of the membership of both the House and the Senate. So they're expected to pass, and that would allow them to move right to third reading, which would be the final vote on the bill, and send it on to the governor.
Well, if we get back on track here, we were starting to talk about the results of the primary election here, and you had a chance to cover some of the races in particular, the ones that involved the State House. Let's start in here first with the one that seems to be of interest around Northwest Indiana, the House District race that would be for the seat that Charlie Brown has retired from. And we had Reagan Hatcher and Jessica Renslow as the two Democratic Party candidates vying for that particular seat. How did you see it, and how did things turn out that on election night?
Yeah, Reagan Hatcher, daughter of former Gary Mayor Richard Hatcher, won that seat pretty handily. She was endorsed by Charlie Brown, who actually got his political career working for Richard Hatcher, or got his political career started working for Richard Hatcher. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of a natural choice for him to endorse her. She's been on the Gary City Council for 6 years. So there's no Republican running yet. They have until July to potentially file a candidate. So, but it is a very Democratic district, so she's likely to be serving in the General Assembly
I was going to ask you if it seems that with the way the makeup of the district is there, that there's going to be a chance that the Republican Party Lake County organization is going to just go ahead and concern themselves with other major races and kind of leave this one aside.
Yeah, they do tend to. There's a few districts in the northern part of the county that tend to not draw Republican opponents that often. Mm-hmm. Just because, in fact, you could say they are gerrymandered. They pack a lot of Democrats into those districts in order to make some of the mid-Lake County districts, thinking like in Munster, the 12th district that Mara Reardon was in, that she went back and forth with Bill Fine, the Republican, trading it for a few years, make those districts more competitive. So.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, the town of Highlands is a good example of that, as well as Munster, is that the makeup is maybe it may lean more to the Republican side than the Democratic side.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, and this is how gerrymandering works. That you can either you can pack everybody in to one district, so you lose the seat, but the other districts are more competitive, or you can split one party into many different districts, so they have no chance of getting a majority. So, yeah. You know, this is why a lot of people at the State House are advocating for independent redistricting in 2021, where the legislature will draw new legislative boundaries. It hasn't moved in the State House because the people in power probably want to stay in power, but there is a definite movement to try and do something to restrict gerrymandering going forward.
Mm-hmm. And checking on some of the other races here, I know that you kept track of on election night. Another one here in Northwest Indiana of interest is the one for the Indiana State Senate District 1. That's the seat that Frank Brevan has been holding for a long time, and it looks like that he's going to be back in the fray here for November too.
Yeah, he has a Republican opponent this time, but it's generally a Democratic district. I mean, Frank Mervan's had the seat for all but 3 years since 1978. So if you were a betting person, you would probably put some money on him winning re-election. And assuming he does and then serves his full term, he will have served more than 40 years in the Senate, which would be the most for any state senator.
Now, we know that Father Mark Murkowski, was the big challenger of the two that were going up against Senator Mervan, and we know that that Father Mark was very vocal about the fact that he thought there was some need for changes. Do you think that maybe that in light of the fact that that Senator Mervan got this kind of indication from a challenger that he should look at something different maybe with the next legislative session, if of course he makes it through after the November general elections?
Right. Well, and part of the problem is there's only 9 Democrats in the Senate out of mm-hmm. 50 members, so they don't have that much influence. Senator Mervan has actually done a pretty good job of working with Republicans to get some things done. Some of his colleagues are much more standoffish and don't get anything done. Senator Mervan ends up serving on a lot of conference committees at the end of session, where there's bills that have passed the House and the Senate with separate provisions, and lawmakers need to get together and figure out a compromise version of that I think Republicans respect Senator Mervan's experience and long tenure in the Senate, and he's chosen to serve on a lot of those committees where they're trying to hash out the final version of a new law.
I got the impression when he was in the studio and we were talking with him about that, it was almost a point of pride that he fashioned himself as being able to talk with folks on the other side of the aisle to be able to try and work problems out if there were any.
Yeah, he's always been a very pragmatic politician. He wants to look out for his constituents in Northwest Indiana first, and then to Democratic Party interests more generally. Mm-hmm. But he always puts Northwest Indiana first, as far as I've seen him, that leads to deal making and compromises if your people are going to benefit.
One of the other races I know that you had a chance to keep an eye on from Northwest Indiana that would be involved in the state legislature is the Indiana House District 2. That's where State Representative Earl Harris Jr. and had two opponents on the ballot on Tuesday. Had his chance, and successfully so, to go back in November and face up, I'm sure, maybe the same situation as what Reagan Hatcher may face. Who knows, as far as whether he'll have a Republican opponent or not, but he certainly had a chance to get back on the ballot.
He did. He defeated Rose Rodriguez and Jason Reeves. Jason Reeves is kind of a perennial candidate. He used to run in a lot of Republican races. Rose Rodriguez lost to Harris in 2016. She's also twice challenged his residency at the Indiana Election Commission and lost. As you know, the Harris family at this point has held this seat since 1982. Earl Harris's father held it for an extended period of time. Then after he died in 2015, Earl Harris's mother, Donna Harris, was elected by the precinct committeeman to finish her husband's term, and then Earl Harris Jr. was first elected in 2016 to, and he was very explicit about it, to carry on his family's legacy. So it's important for him to continue to represent East Chicago in this seat at the State House.
And one other race here we want to talk about here in particular that you kept an eye on is because it involves another person like Charlie Brown, who decided not to run for re-election, but obviously a much more influential Democrat, it seems, as Representative Scott Peleth, with his time serving, including that as being a leader of the minority party in the Indiana House. He had another challenger, I guess, for the seat. Tell us about Pat Boy, and since she is now going to go on facing a Republican in November, how that election seemed to turn out.
Yeah, Scott Peleth was the House Democratic leader for a few years. He gave it up before the start of the 2018 session. He recently got remarried, had a new child, wants to spend more time in Michigan City rather than driving to Indianapolis,
kind of the same
back
way
and forth every
the
week.
Same way that Charlie Brown was talking about it when he decided he was not going to run for re-election, that he was tired of making the long trek on I-65 in the middle of winter. Yeah,
yeah, it really is. Obviously this is their job, but any normal person would question why they keep doing this.
Yeah, that's true. It's your job, but and you do it because you like the job. It's the incentive of, I guess, knowing that after the long trek across the diagonally across the state of Indiana to the center of the state, you're there and you get to go to work. I suppose you're looking forward to that part of it, I would imagine. So
yeah, but driving up and down I-65 in the winter is always an adventure. So
that's true. That's
to
true.
Do it every week for. In 16 weeks in the long session, so that's a lot of work. I mean, you're pulled out of your life, you're pulled out of your job for 4 months to live somewhere else for half of every week. It's a big commitment, it's a big job. People, it is a part-time job, but when you're down here, you're working 16, 18-hour days, whether at the State House or meeting with people or attending fundraisers or whatever. I think legislators don't get enough credit for how much work they actually do put in for their constituents. That's
true. Well, and we'll see what happens as Pat Boy goes up against Dan Granquist in November, and see how that race happens to shape up. And I know the other really big race that you kept a close eye on election night that you had in your stories in the Times online and in print involving the U.S. Senate GOP nomination. And, of course, we know how it turned out. Mike Braun is the person who's going to go up against Senator
Donnelly.
That's right, Senator Joe Donnelly. I was looking here to find out more on the information I had here on if it had anything that Mr. Braun had to say in particular, but he really didn't say much on a victory speech, I understand.
Yeah, he's made his point throughout the primary. He, like Rokita and Messer, sees himself as very loyal to Trump, very loyal to the Republican agenda that the president is putting forward. He fashions himself, similar to Trump, as an outsider businessman, even though he did serve 3 years as a member of the Indiana House. And tonight he's going to be in Elkhart alongside the president and Vice President Pence and presumably get the endorsement. And, well, obviously he's going to get the endorsement. He's the candidate. But, you know, that's a good photo of him next to the president and the vice president, making the case that they're a united team. Indiana in 2016 went for Trump by 19%, and Braun's supporters and Braun's campaign obviously thinks appealing to those voters in 2018 is the way to get elected to the Senate.
And I get the impression, too, that Senator Joe Donnelly is not going to be afraid of getting a nice mix-up going there with Mike Braun on the campaign trail this fall.
No, and Donnelly has had no problem defending his record. He's taken a lot of hits already from the Republicans about his vote against the president's tax cuts, and he hits them right back by pointing out that it's going to reduce federal revenue by $2 trillion, and that's probably not a smart thing to do if you call yourself a fiscal conservative, as Republicans like to do, because you're taking the nation's deficit problem and making it exponentially worse. So Donnelly has a point to make on that side, too. Republicans think if they tell Hoosiers they're getting more money in their paychecks, even if some Hoosiers aren't seeing it, that's going to be the way to get their guy elected.
Well, Dan Carton, thank you very much for spending time with us to go through in more detail on the issues not only involving the coverage of the primary elections on Tuesday night, but also the upcoming special legislative session that you'll get to keep a close eye on very soon. Dan Carton covers events that happen involving state government for the Times of Northwest Indiana down in Indianapolis. And as always, thank you for being with us. And we'll look forward to having a chance to check back in with you here as we get the special session underway and hopefully finished up soon.
Yeah, should be over and done, begun and done on Monday.
It's great. We'll check back with you later then on that. Thanks very much. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. We'll get back to talking about how the race has turned out from election night. Let's check in now with Lauren Cross with the Times about a story that she's put in print and online here of news from the city of Gary. A very interesting conversation, I guess, that Gary City Council members and the staff on City Hall have to have here about some financial questions that apparently have popped up. And Lauren, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, give us a rundown here on what the problem seems to be and why everybody seems to be concerned about this accounting problem.
Right. So Councilwoman Lavetta Sparks-Wade, she chairs the council's ambulance committee, and she told me she was going over the books with fire personnel some time ago and noticed there was something was up with the city's ambulance fund, EMS fund. It supports their EMS services. So essentially, the Chase Bank statements and the city accounting systems were showing two different balances. The Chase Bank was showing a balance of about $300,000. The city's accounting system showed the balance was at $5.2 million. So there was, as she called it, a noticeable discrepancy of $4.9 million that was unaccounted for in this restrictive funding source.
What have you learned in your looking into this and talking with people, including Councilwoman Sparks-Wade, about this accounting system that the city of Gary seems to have? It's not often I would think you'd have such a discrepancy like that. How does it seem that they work out their accounting system?
Right, and it is pretty substantial figure, $4.9 million.
Mm-hmm.
You know, shortly after she brought this to their attention, Karen Freeman-Wilson, she mentioned that, you know, a review of their accounting system shortly followed after that. Sparks Wade described it as an internal audit. The chief of staff has described it as an internal audit. And basically the goal of the audit is to find out where exactly the $4.9 million went. When I spoke with Sparks Wade, she didn't have any specifics in front of her. And I think so far they've declined to disclose, you know, which city departments were pulling from this restrictive funding source. I'm hoping once this executive session's over, they'll be more, you know, willing to speak about that.
Do you get the impression that maybe because of the way that the accounting system is, that with that amount of money that happened to be sitting in that restricted account there that was supposed to go for the ambulance and the EMS services mm-hmm. related expenses, that it got drawn to pay other city bills?
Right. One thing I wanted to mention, too, is that mm-hmm. the mayor, you know, she wouldn't classify this necessarily as criminal. You know, these funds were possibly used for legitimate city purposes, but it was outside of the scope of the fund's restrictions. So there is obviously some issue here. I mean, when you're talking about $4.9 million misuse of funds, but I don't think I would classify it as criminal. I really don't know at this point, but it is, you know, a substantial issue, and hopefully we'll learn more after the executive session on Friday.
I would think, too, that the Indiana State Board of Accounts would probably be wanting to know a lot more about what's happening here, and I'm sure that they're waiting to find out more from Mayor Freeman Wilson and everybody else that is working on the staff at City Hall to help out in this.
Yeah, that's one of my questions right now. I'm curious how they're going to react to this and, you know, if they're going to be involved moving forward. That's actually what I've got a call into them this afternoon mm-hmm. to find that out. So it's what's interesting here is, you know, you have this substantial amount of money that's unaccounted for, withdrawn possibly over a 2-year period, and it didn't become an issue until a council person flagged it a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, I hope to learn more in the next couple of weeks.
Oh, we know, yeah, the State Board of Accounts tends to want to do investigations on a rather orderly basis, not just based on media reports, but just the same, there's been so much coverage here in the last few days about all this. I'm sure it can't but not draw attention in Indianapolis about this.
Oh, absolutely. And as we all know, you know, the city of Gary is already under pretty intense scrutiny and a microscope for their, you know, their school system. So, you know, this wouldn't be outside of the authority of the State Board of Accounts, and I'm sure they're already potentially looking into this. Who knows? We'll find out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess mm-hmm. we have to have the concern, too, that if they figure out a way to deal with how the funds got misspent, they're probably going to have to do some other examination as far as personnel is concerned about all this, too. And I imagine that's probably one reason why a lot of this either has not only been taken up already, but probably will in the future be taken up in the executive session.
Right. Yeah, so they actually issued a notice yesterday, I believe, that they're will be meeting an executive session 5 p.m. Friday. The notice was sent out stating that they will be discussing a job performance evaluation of individual employees. I think the meeting will involve the mayor, the comptroller, Angela Hayes, the chief of staff, the city's financial and legal advisors. But we do want to make note, too, that any final action that they discuss, any discussion they have, So any final action must be taken at a meeting open to the public. So they can't take any final action on any personnel matters.
So they may have a question, I guess, like I said, it may come up here in the discussion in closed session about dealing with this. And I know you mentioned in your other stories that are online and in print about the fact that even though, you know, you mentioned just now here about the fact that from what the mayor had said that maybe there may not be any criminal intent, but there may be some problems with staffers and whatever, whoever was me, might have been responsible for keeping track of the money, that they may have to make some personnel changes. But I suppose they can talk about that, of course, in closed session. But as you say, they can't actually take official action.
Right. So hopefully we do learn more in the next couple of weeks once this executive session gets out of the way. You know, obviously transparency is critical here when you have $4.9 million at stake.
Yeah. In talking with your colleagues there at the Times, I'm sure they probably have a chance to discuss about the situation in past years involving the city of Gary. And you already mentioned, of course, and we all know about the fact that the city has been short on funds, has had to have some help from Indianapolis in the years past in keeping the books straightened out and keeping the bills paid and the like. And I'm sure they're probably looking back and seeing some parallels to some other past problems.
Yeah. I think, you know, that's also something to keep in mind when reporting on the city of Gary. And, you know, when you have this kind of substantial amount missing, you know, you have to wonder, do they have, you know, do they have it under control?
Yeah.
And you know, if.
Well, I guess we'll find out, and we'll certainly learn more here after this meeting coming up here on Friday, tomorrow, and we appreciate finding more out about that as well. We've been talking with Lauren Cross, who's been covering the story for the Times of Northwest Indiana, the issue involving the direction of funds and how money was used from a restricted funding source that may involves the EMS operations in the city of Gary. And the question has come up now, where's the money gone? We'll be interested to find out how things develop from that. And thanks, Lauren, for being with us today to talk about it.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Let's continue on with Reporters Roundtable Thursday and getting back into how things turned out on the 2018 primary election races here in Northwest Indiana and Lake County in particular. Bill Dolan with the Times of Northwest Indiana joining us today. Bill, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you had a busy night, to be sure. I guess all you folks with the Times had a busy night on election night to keep track of what was happening here. Let's kind of go through the list here. And there are some interesting races that we know, and I'm sure some that have, in a way, have yet to be resolved. And one of those in particular, I know, is involving Lake County Councilman Eldon Strong. Tell us how things turned out on election night and if there's anything else we may get to see in the paper from him, about him.
Well, the one unresolved yet to be decided is the 7th District of the Lake County Council.
Mm-hmm.
That covers Crown Point in much of South County. Kristen Jorgensen appears to have defeated Eldon Strong, the incumbent councilman, by 2 votes. 2,219 to 2,217.
Wow!
And what has to happen now is that routinely the election board will go through all of the materials in the 527 precincts, looking for any paper ballots. We have these things called provisional ballots, where if a voter doesn't have their identification, state-issued identification, or if there's some question about whether they're registered to vote or whether they're voting in the right precinct, the polling place can deny them the right to work to cast a vote on a electronic voting machine,
right.
But they can cast a paper ballot, and then their circumstances can be investigated between Election Day and 10 days hence. That would be next Friday, the 18th.
Mm-hmm.
And then the election board will decide whether to count that vote or not count that vote. So the question then becomes, are there provisional ballots? And if there are any of them in the 7th district? And if any of them are in the 7th district, who did they vote for in this race? We won't find that out, as I said, until next week. But that's one of the things we're waiting on. And if the outcome doesn't change, Councilman Strong can file a recount suit, which can be a very expensive endeavor. Thousands of dollars were spent in the last major recount. And he might come out on top, or he might still be short.
Yeah.
So we have a ways to go before we have left that particular race.
I understand in your story that there was a relatively recent major recount that did happen. Tell us about that. And you kind of referred to it just a moment ago about the fact that it was a very expensive proposition.
Yes, that was 6 years ago. It involved the commissioner race, and Commissioner Mike Repe had won that. That was an empty seat. He and another gentleman whose name I'm trying to recall at the moment.
Oh, Richard Novak? Is that the fellow?
Thank you. Richard Novak. Yeah. Mr. Novak is now on the North Township Advisory Board.
Yeah, I was going to say, I saw his yard signs out, so he was looking to get on the board.
He won that one.
Yeah.
But 6 years ago, he was running for commissioner, and he was 74 votes short out of 130 precincts, 11,000 votes cast. They went over all of them. They were able to cut that lead about in half, but he still came out on the short side of that. And that was, as I said, 6 years ago. It wasn't really that close. Mr. Novak said he would advise Mr. Strong to go ahead with it, but he warns that it can cost money.
Yeah, I know. What did Mr. Novak tell you about that recount that he had to ask for?
Well, it took several days. He had to hire a number of lawyers. You have to pay for a recount staff too. And there's court fees, and you have to pay $10 per precinct. As I said, 130 precincts in that commissioner district. There's 70, or about 70, in the seventh district council district where Mr. Strong is. So it's bound to cost a lot of money, and no guarantee, of course, that it'll get you where you need to go.
Well, there's another great story coming out of the primary election that you'll get to follow here in the days ahead. I'm sure it'll come up here. One story I know that you did get to cover, and it just happened to be resolved at least on election night, was going through the pack of Democratic challengers looking for a job called the Lake County Sheriff. Tell us how Oscar Martinez did, and certainly how he felt about making it.
Well, as our headline said, it was an Oscar night.
Yes.
Oscar was always the man to beat. He, of course, became sheriff last September when former Sheriff John Buntzich was convicted in August. His office became vacant. He was convicted of bribery. And a caucus was held for precinct committeemen all over Lake County, and they chose Oscar among several candidates. And so he's been holding the office since then and has made a number of moves. He's hired a new warden. He's trying to get overtime under control. He has a number of initiatives. And, of course, he had campaigned two previous times unsuccessfully against former Sheriff Buntzich. So he was well known in the political circles. He received all of the just about all of the political endorsements. He received the lion's share of the money. We had eight Democrats running in the race for sheriff, and he was head and shoulders above all of them on election night.
Mm-hmm. I know you're talking about endorsements that Sheriff Martinez got. One of the biggest you could possibly get here in Lake County is from a former Democratic Party chairman, a fellow who I guess had that job before John Buntzich had taken it. And we're talking about Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. And I know that Oscar Martinez is very pleased, and I'm sure that Tom McDermott Jr. was as well.
He was there on election night at Sheriff Martinez's campaign celebration. Got a big hug, and yes, Hammond was huge in Martinez's victory. But I think he it was surprising how well he did throughout the county. This was a low turnout, 17% of the voters, so almost 2 out of 10 voted, the rest stayed home. He was probably the best organized candidate, and he was strong in areas that where the vote comes out, whether it's a high or a low turnout. So that's a good reason why he won Tuesday.
Okay, but one of the other stories I know that you've covered here is which is not involved in the election. I guess it does in a way, only peripherally, because it involves the Lake County Treasurer, Peggy Katona, who won her nomination in the primary election. But it involves the fact that we have some last-minute taxes for some people to pay, and the Treasurer's Office set out some information about that. Tell us about that, please.
Well, of course, today is the last day for the spring installment, which is half of the annual tax bill. And the office will be open until 6:30 p.m. The offices, I should say, Crown Point, Gary, and Hammond in the county courthouses in those cities. And, of course, people can pay at their local bank. Most of them have a connection with the treasurer's office. And they can also mail it in as long as the postmark is dated for today and not after that. Otherwise, there's penalties involved. The office is also the treasurer's office is also now accepting credit cards for payments. There is a fee, slightly under 3%, that gets charged. But if you don't have the cash, you have that convenience to use your credit card.
Well, something to rush to the county government center or to the bank to be able to take care of, it seems, if you haven't gotten your property taxes paid for the spring installment. Bill Dolan's the reporter for The Times, covers Lake County government, spent a lot of time, of course, with the candidates in the primary election, but added an opportunity here to pass on this last-minute word for last-minute taxpayers. And as always, Bill, thank you for spending time with us here on the program. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Talk to you again soon. Take care. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Listeners of Regionally Speaking are an active part of the community. They care about their neighborhoods, their schools, and their homes. Are these listeners your customers? They should be. Learn about all the benefits of sponsoring Regionally Speaking today at 219-756-5656.
We're getting word of more contamination problems because of lead and other toxics in Northwest Indiana. This time we're finding out about another lead-contaminated neighborhood near East Chicago. And to that, we are turning to the fellow who wrote the story for the Chicago Tribune, Michael Hawthorne. He's covered other environmental issues. We've had him on before to talk about them. And Michael, thanks for joining us again on Regionally Speaking.
Great to be with you.
Well, fill us in here is what we know so far about the problems that more neighborhoods in Northwest Indiana, in particular around Hammond and around Whiting, are facing now.
This is very similar to what happened in East Chicago, where there was lead smelters that were abandoned long ago. In this case, in the Hammond-Whiting area, it was a facility called Federated Metals that operated from the early 1930s to the early 1980s. And, you know, a lot of other industry in the area, neighborhoods were built very close to these places where people worked, right? And so I think people have been accustomed, longtime people who've lived in the neighborhoods, they're accustomed to the fact that they live close to industry. But what we're finding now, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency was created in the early 1970s. They went after some of the really tough, easy-to-see sources of pollution, say U.S. Steel dumping waste into Lake Michigan. Not. And what I think is going on now is they're going back and looking at some of these sites that they might have taken a look at, or they might have done some level of cleanup years ago, and they're finding that it wasn't enough. And of greater concern for people in the Robertsdale neighborhood of Hammond and in Whiting, the lead from Federated Metals appears to have drifted far beyond the property where the smelter operated. And so you're finding, what the EPA is finding, is that there are staggeringly high levels of lead in residential soil. And so far, at least, EPA has not done a lot in terms of informing residents what they might be facing.
Are we finding in these cases, from what you can tell, and maybe you've found out from some of the documents you've looked into, that this migration of the contamination is either maybe from airborne material, or if it's maybe, for example,
it's almost certain that the material we're talking about here either was emitted through what they call fugitive dust. A lot of these facilities had big vents where waste that didn't go up a smokestack. Pollution just went out into the air and drifted into the neighborhood. Prevailing winds from this particular facility would generally go toward the north and the northeast. So we're talking Robertsdale and Whiting. And, most of the time that this facility operated, there wasn't an EPA, and there wasn't really a lot of pollution control laws or regulations on the books. What I was really struck by reading some of the historic documents that the Indiana Department of Environmental Management and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency have posted, they were very concerned in the 1980s about ground contamination from Federated Metals.
Mm-hmm.
And they were they were concerned about this from other facilities in the area as well. It appears that no one ever bothered to ask, did the whole pollution that came out of this particular facility, was it deposited in the yards of neighbors close by? They're finding that out now. So it seems like every time they they sample soil somewhere in northwest Indiana and southeast Chicago. They're finding dangerous levels of different heavy metals that have been used by industry in the area for a long time. In some cases, they're still being used. Mm-hmm. And what they're finding is cause for concern because it can be harmful not only to young children but also to adults.
I know you talked to some residents who live there along Lakeview Street, which is just north of where the smelter used to be located there in Robertsdale, and they're very, very concerned not only about the potential contamination that they're facing now, but also the fact they never got told very much, if at all, by any officials about it.
Well, I think some people would just think, hey, that building was there for quite a while. Mm-hmm. It was vacant or was used for other purposes. People who pay really close attention to environmental issues in Northwest Indiana have pointed out to Governor Holcomb and to members of the environmental agency that they're finding this legacy of pollution in the neighborhoods at the same time that the state of Indiana is permitting other lead processing facilities to operate in the same building. Mm-hmm. Now, they might not release as much pollution as was estimated to come out of the Federated Metals smelter when it was operating there, but it's still a source of lead. And back in December, when IDEM renewed a permit for the current occupant, it's called Whiting Metals, there were a number of concerns from people in the Robertsdale and Whiting neighborhoods that there should be a public hearing, that there should be an airing of public concerns, not only about historic contamination from old abandoned industry in the area, also from current emitting facilities. IDEM said no to that, and they renewed the permit, but these issues still remain.
I know that you have in your story that's online in the Tribune and in the Post Tribune, as well as available in the print version, talking about the fact that we had EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt and Governor Eric Holcomb coming up in the area, and they apparently slipped in and took a look at some of this and never told anybody, or certainly the media never found out, and the neighbors certainly apparently didn't find out either.
That's one of these odd things, and we're seeing a lot in the national press about Pruitt's secret visits, oftentimes very tight security. I counted on a video that one of the neighborhood activists shot with their camera phone at least three security members around Pruitt and Holcomb during this surprise visit to a yard near the Federated Metals plant or building. And again, right, like you said, there was no media announcement of this until after the fact. In fact, Hammond's mayor wasn't even notified of it. So they showed up. I'm not exactly sure what the reason was, other than to be photographed. The governor and Administrator Pruitt were photographed shaking hands, flanked by the Whiting mayor and by the regional administrator for the EPA here in the Chicago office. But there wasn't a lot of details, and it wasn't until I started asking questions of the EPA, hey, what do you know about this facility? What are you going to be doing in the future about the lead you've already found in the neighborhood? It took them a while to kind of come up with some answers to that, because I think the Trump administration's EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, caught people by surprise by showing up suddenly and then saying, hey, we're going to earmark $1.7 million to clean up at least 20 homes where women and children are living and they could be especially at risk to lead poisoning. It raises a lot of other questions about the rest of the neighborhood, how much more testing is going to be done. In April, the EPA was out there. Not a lot of people know about this, but the EPA was out once again testing soil in the neighborhood. There are no results yet from that. This is very similar to what Pruitt did in East Chicago, where he visited the Superfund site there, the West Calumet housing project that's now being torn down. Paid a secret visit there to East Chicago and said this was going to be one of his top priorities. There are a lot of open questions about the pace of the cleanup, the extent of the cleanup, and then just at basic level, the public notification about what's going on.
I know you had a chance to speak with David Dapperton from Hammond, who used to work for IDEM when they used to have a Northwest Indiana office back, I guess, in the early 1990s. I'm sure that he's very concerned about this and had a chance to talk with some of the neighbors in the area about it, too.
I get a sense talking with him, and it's from reading some of old news clippings where he was quoted about different issues back in the 90s. He struck me as kind of a Don Quixote effort, trying to raise more attention about current and former industry in Northwest Indiana. As far as he sees it, the folks down in Indianapolis just don't want to hear about that. They don't necessarily want to pay attention at all, in his mind, to Northwest Indiana. But what happens is there are people like Dapperton and Thomas Frank in the Hammond area, and activists who are they're getting together with people in East Chicago and the southeast side of Chicago and Flint, Michigan, and other places around the country that have been impacted by industrial pollution, and they're raising questions, and they're essentially forcing public officials accountable to start telling people what they might be exposed to out there. And it is, I think, very concerning. Everybody that I've talked to in those areas, if they find out what's going on, they're very concerned. The question is, are they looking for these things?
Well, I guess we'll find out if EPA or IDEM or some agency that will take a look into this more detail will finally come up with an opportunity there to hold another public hearing, much as what I'm sure they are not necessarily looking forward to, but it's turned out to be that way, to be sure. Michael Hawthorne is a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He has a story that is in print and online here about another discovery of another lead-contaminated neighborhood near East Chicago. And, Michael, thanks very much for being with us to talk about this today.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. And our many thanks to the reporters that have helped us out on the program today from The Times, Bill Dolan, Dan Carden, Carmen McCollum, and Lauren Cross. And from the Chicago Tribune, Michael Hawthorne. Back with you on Monday. Have a nice weekend.